Keri Phillips here, and thanks for downloading another of Rear Vision's summer podcasts. The invention of the shipping container turned the shipping industry inside out and made global trade possible. But as with any transformative change, there were winners and losers, as I discovered when I made this Rear Vision. Hello and welcome to Rear Vision. I'm Keri Phillips, and today, the story of the big box that changed the world.
No justification for a 4% increase in freight rates for Australian wool bound for Europe. Mr. Ian Sinclair, the Minister for Shipping and Transport, was commenting in Sydney today on the agreement reached in Paris between shipping companies and representatives of the wool industry. And he told Harold Abrams,
by the end of this year, there'll be 13 of the UK-Europe container vessels operating. And it is claimed and it has been demonstrated that container vessels have some economies. Now, we believe that those economies should be shared between the ship owners and the shippers.
Australia's Minister for Shipping and Transport speaking about the savings to be made by first packing goods into big, reusable steel boxes before loading them onto ships. But in 1970, the dawn of the container era, the Minister couldn't have imagined how things would turn out. Before the arrival of the shipping container, although some goods were carried boxed or palletized, much was carried as bulk, just loaded directly into a ship's hold. It was labour-intensive and took a long time, sometimes up to 3 weeks, during which time the ship's crew would be idle. In the mid-1950s, an American trucking company owner was casting about to find a cheaper and more reliable way of transporting his goods from New York to New Orleans than by road. Malcolm McLean bought an old oil tanker and began experimenting, packing goods in containers and loading them onto the ship. He wasn't the only one to think of adapting an idea that goes back thousands of years to the amphora, and by the late 1960s, specifications were in place for a standard box. Professor Brian Slack of Concordia University in Canada is an expert on the story of container shipping.
In the early days, different lines or different experimenters in container shipping were using boxes of different dimensions. They had their own system, they built their own ships, they had the cranes which were suited to that particular type of box. But fortunately, the International Standards Organization, which was is still today the most important agency which tries to standardize dimensions and features, came to conclusions that imposed on the rest of the world a standard box. And the box was identified as being 8 foot high, 8 foot wide, and 20 foot long. And this is the unit of measurement today. We still call it the 20 foot equivalent unit. Because, in fact, the ISO also allowed and considered the extension of the size in length to the 40-foot box. So you had boxes of 40 feet by 8 by 8, and you had boxes of 20 feet by 8 by 8. And that was the standard that all the companies who wanted to get involved in containerization around the world have had to adopt. And in terms of containerization, which became a global phenomenon, it would have had great difficulty in doing that were it not for the fact that the boxes that everybody adopted were of a fixed dimension. And the key to that is that you could design the ship to fit explicitly those dimensions of boxes. In other words, you would have various slots built into the wide open holes of ships, so you could slide the containers, either the 20-foot or the 40-foot boxes, down the slot into the hold of the ship. Similarly, you could design and develop cranes on land, on the dockside, that could lift and move the containers of that dimension. This was one of the great impetuses that led to the success of containerization.
It also meant that shipping companies had to build new ships.
Definitely. It was evident from the first experiments of Malcolm McLean that you could not convert an existing ship. Some companies tried it. But it was uneconomic. The carrying capacity of the ships, where you were simply trying to squeeze or put boxes into the existing holes, was not competitive with the ships that were designed to handle containers. And so the first vessels that were designed, which were fully container vessels, were developed in the 1960s, and they would have a capacity of about 1,000, 1,500, what are called TEUs, 20-foot equivalent units. And that was far in excess of the capacity of simply converting an existing cargo vessel. And so this was a big capital investment required for many of the companies. And this was quite a shock to shipping lines because, of course, for the last 50, 100 years, they'd had basically the same design of vessel to carry the general cargo. Now they had to invest in new types of ships that could not carry general cargo or any other type of cargo. They were specifically designed for containers. And this represented quite a challenge to some of the existing shipping lines. And many of the traditional shipping companies ultimately decided not to pursue containerization, simply because it was going to be too expensive for them to compete in. And furthermore, in the early days, they were not convinced that the container would be successful.
Containerization would also completely transform ports and the nature of dock work.
Containerization is seen as a quick and lasting remedy for this. Old, dirty, congested wharves serving equally old-fashioned vessels equipped with slow and cumbersome cargo handling gear. In 1966, the sight of muscle-powered hand barrows to move cargo from ship to shore is a straight reflection of waterfront methods and conditions of over 30 years ago. While this remains, turnaround time for shipping in some of our ports will continue to be among the world's slowest.
Traditionally, a port used to have a relatively small imprint. That is, you had docks, you have a few warehouses, immediately adjacent to those warehouses, you could have factories or even residential district.
Dr. John Paul Rodrigue is a scholar of transportation geography at Hofstra University in New York. I spoke to him by Skype.
In many older ports, the residential district where dock workers were living were right next or adjacent to the port facility. So when containerization arrived, you suddenly needed a lot of spaces to stack all those containers. So the old port sites were no longer judged to be suitable in the great majority of the cases. So you have to redesign, then you have to build new facilities further away. So that was, in a sense, the major impact that containers had on port facilities. It forced them to move towards new sites. So I can give you an example. The Port of New York, which used to be around Manhattan or in Brooklyn in the past, let's say up to the 1950s and 60s, is now almost entirely New Jersey.
The typical old port design, what you had to do because a ship was in port for a long period of time, it meant you had to have lots of berths. And the only way you could accommodate large numbers of ships, because they were there for weeks at a time, was to have a series of finger piers, usually jetties that were put out into the ocean or out into the rivers to enable a large number of berths to be made available. And because you were loading and unloading goods from the ship, and because land transportation was very limited, the result was that you had to have the storage sheds immediately on the dockside. And so a typical feature of the port of the 1940s and 50s was storage sheds, finger piers, lots of berthing space. But when you get to containerization, you don't need the storage space because the goods are in a container. They're not exposed to the weather. And it needs, because a ship is coming in, it's carrying now, in the early days anyway, 1,000, 1,500 containers. You had to have a lot of space on the dock to store those containers. And so one of the very big impacts of containerization was not the cost that the shipping lines had to face, it was the cost the ports had to face. And they had to completely rethink their operations. And many started to convert existing docks, knocking down sheds as much as they could. But these proved not to be as efficient as developing new terminals on new sites to accommodate the container vessels that were coming in. And ports began to move out of their traditional locations in the heart of cities, the old dock sides of cities, and were moving into what are called greenfield sites where new port facilities were built.
The Edgewater, New Jersey terminal of sea train lines, railroad, highway, and ocean transportation is blended. In addition to carrying conventional railroad cars of all kinds and its own 40-foot long containers, Sea Train has arrangements with several railroads whereby container vans and trailers are handled on its vessels. All the benefits of rail shipment and containerization including door-to-door delivery of sealed vans, are enjoyed by shippers who are dispatching cargo to ports served by Seatrain.
There were winners and losers as the shipping industry was turned inside out. Some ports struggled with the financial costs of adjusting to containerization, while others found themselves in the wrong place.
So, for example, in Britain, the old port cities of Liverpool and Bristol, which were on the west side of Britain, found themselves on the wrong side of the country. Britain was getting many of its containers from Rotterdam. Rotterdam was becoming Europe's main, what they like to call themselves, the main port of Europe. And they were investing very heavily in container facilities right from the very beginning. But that meant that to go to Liverpool or Bristol or Glasgow, that was an enormous detour. It was a time cost factor. And therefore, if they were to serve the British market, they would want to serve ports either on the south coast, Southampton, or on the east coast, London, but in particular, a totally new port that was created, and that was Felixstowe. And Felixstowe was a sleepy resort until that time, and it was developed initially as a container facility. And although it is 100 kilometers from London, it was within access of the metropolitan region by road and by train. And so there was a total dislocation in Britain in terms of container handling. The same thing was true in the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean, which had been an important place of shipping, found itself now a backwater because the container ships coming from Asia were not willing to call at them, and they went straight through the Suez Canal, through the Strait of Gibraltar to Rotterdam. All through the world, we see ports having some success and other ports failing. One example of this was in the United States, when with the growth of Asian trade, the East Coast ports, like New York and Baltimore and Philadelphia, found themselves on the wrong side of the United States. And so, yes, there was winners and losers in ports. The other very big loser, and people don't really talk about this, but on the other hand, it was probably the most serious effect of containerization, was to reduce the amount of manpower in the ports. Whereas before, gangs of laborers working long hours in the port on long shifts resulted in a very large labor force being required. But with containers, manpower was supplanted by cranes and other kinds of dockside equipment. And the result was a significant, I mean, a very large reduction in the need for manpower. I mean, there were gainers on this, that some of the dock workers were able to stay on and gain higher salaries. With the mechanization that was going on, the crane drivers, for example, received very generous salaries. But the demand for labor that once existed in port cities has diminished very, very significantly. And I think that is probably the biggest change and dislocation that has occurred as a result of containerization.
This is Rear Vision with Kerry Phillips on RN, online, on mobile and by podcast. Today we're hearing the story of container shipping and how it changed the world. The workers on these new kinds of ships also found that their lives had been transformed, and not in a good way. Journalist Rose George travelled by container ship from the British port Felixstowe to Singapore for her book 90% of Everything.
Well, is it a hard life? All the Filipino crew said to me when I asked them if they enjoyed their job, they said, it's dollar for homesickness. Seafarers often joke, except they're not really joking, that their job is prison with a salary. So it can be good money with a good company, with a good manning agency. It can be good money, and that's why they're at sea, after all. They're there to earn money. For a Filipino, for example, a decent job on even as an AB, an able seaman on a ship, can be a wage that's three times that of a government employee in Manila. So that's why they're at sea. But they've all very, very carefully calculated how long they're going to be there. They figured out that it's 12 years or 15 years, and then they can go home. It's definitely, they're not at sea for the love of being at sea, or at least no one I met was. Now, my captain was a very different matter because he had been at sea for 42 years. So he had seen a different shipping world when he grew up. He had these ships that had all the break bulk cargo, so all the kind of mixture of items, not these containers. And what that meant was that it took longer to unload and load up a ship. So a ship was longer in port. Whereas today, because containerization has made shipping so incredibly efficient, even a ship like the one I was on, which was carrying nearly 7,000 containers, even that could be fully discharged and charged in less than 24 hours. And we would never import for more than 24 hours. And that means that the people on board have often, on average, no more than 2 hours ashore, which means they often don't leave the dock area. They can't go into town. They don't get any proper R&R when they're ashore. It's not like it used to be. It's a much harder rhythm of life at sea, and it is hard work. So even at sea, a ship needs constantly being cared for because it rusts, things break, there are all these massive metal objects. It's a very harsh environment and it has to be maintained constantly. And of course, if you're a watch officer, then you have to be on the bridge. You have to be there. You have to watch. So they are basically tired a lot of the time, and then they don't get enough relaxation ashore. So fatigue is a really big problem in the industry.
Are container ships particularly dangerous environments?
Yes, they are, because you're surrounded by heavy machinery on the ship. You're surrounded by huge metal boxes that can fall. And you're most importantly, you're surrounded by weather. And you're surrounded by an ocean, which is the most dangerous element on the planet. As much as there are countless regulations, safety regulations governing ships, but two ships a week still sink.
What about the containers themselves? I've heard that sometimes they fall off ships. Is that true?
It is true, and you can see some of these on YouTube. If you can see some sort of crazy stacks of containers. Yes, they do fall off. It's quite hard to know how many do fall off. But the figure that is put about by, for example, the European Union says that 2,000 containers fall off in European waters. The figure that you'll mostly hear is 10,000 a year, though I'm not quite sure how that's been arrived at. The World Shipping Council says it's not that many. So there's all sorts of debate about it. But if you talk to yachters, or particularly people who travel great distances on yachts, they will generally have seen a shipping container bobbing about at some point. So they are out there.
As well as the lives of workers on the docks and on deck, those of workers in the old industrial world and those in what would be called emerging economies were also transformed by container shipping.
What happened in the early years was the goods that used to be transported under general freight, general cargo, which were manufactured goods and some raw materials, but basically it was machinery, it was domestic goods, it was stuff that was manufactured, semi-manufactured, or were components of manufacturing. And these are the goods that were the bread and butter of containerization, at least in the earlier days. And the big factor, and I think I may have mentioned this originally, was the reduction in transport costs. That you could fill a container with lots of manufactured goods. The shipping lines were only charging rates per container. So, for example, a figure that I like to quote is that if a pair of sneakers in the United States, which are made in China, and in the United States are selling for $100 and $150 or more, cost 25 cents to transport because you're stuffing the box with lots of boxes of sneakers. So the transport costs of manufactured goods and finished products was very good. But sooner or later, you hit a barrier in the sense that virtually all the cargoes that traditionally could be converted have been converted. And we're reaching today something like 80%, maybe 90% of this market has now been converted to containers.
Essentially, globalization could not have existed without containerization. It goes hand on hand. That is all the outsourcing, offshoring of large manufacturing activities in developing economies could not be made possible because of the container. It is also absolutely incredible what you can see be put into containers. Everything you can think of course, classic consumer goods, televisions, apparel, shoes, of course, refrigerated goods, fresh fruits, vegetable, meat. And actually, a dirty little secret is that the leading containerized export of North America is actually waste products, waste metals, waste paper, which are put into containers and then shipped across the Pacific to be brought to China. And those goods are going to be recycled into consumer goods and then are going to be re-exported back to the United States. I've seen coffee put into containers, wood, even coal. some instances. Pretty much everything that can be shipped, if it can be done economically, it can be put into a container.
How easy is it to work out whether or not it's economic?
Oh, there's a lot of factors behind this. One aspect is the price of containerized shipping on average has declined over the last 20, 30 years or so because of economies of scale. The ships are getting bigger and the ports are getting bigger, so it's, of course, cheaper to move things around. In some cases, since you have, let's say, imbalanced flows, that is, you have a lot of empties in one direction and a lot of full containers in the other, what happens is on some trade routes, it becomes cheaper to ship goods in one direction than the other because of this imbalance, which means that some people have some kind of an export subsidy because of this imbalanced trade. And to go back to this example I was mentioning to you, that the leading export of North America is waste products. This trade is possible because on one direction, you have a lot of empties that are asking to be filled with something, and the shipping rates are lower. So it becomes possible to do something like that.
Just looking at crime and containerization, has the advent of containerization increased the level of crime? Has it contributed to crime or fraud in any way?
You have to be cautious about this. Containerization enabled to remove a form of crime. What I mean by this is dock workers in the past were at a lot of opportunity to steal from the goods they were handling. So when containerization was introduced, it removed a lot of that risk. So that form of crime was virtually almost disappeared. However, other forms of crime have emerged because of containerization. And we talk about the movement of illicit goods, illegal goods. You could talk about also maybe drugs a little bit, but most of the illicit trade being carried by containers involved, let's say, fake goods. I would say examples that you can think about fake handbags, fake shoes. There are a few things like that, which containerization has probably promoted in a sense that since a container is anonymous, it is a little bit easier to carry stuff that can be judged illegal.
The next generation of giant ships has hit our shores, and the new supersized ships need jumbo ports and facilities.
Every port in Australia is moving to upgrade its facilities, either by channel deepening or by developing the land nearby to increase capacity and improve road and rail links.
One of these is the Port of Melbourne. In 2008, it was dredged to allow for bigger ships, and last week the state government announced plans to develop a third container terminal.
This is Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on RN, online, on mobile and by podcast. Today we're hearing the story of container shipping and how it changed the world. Ships themselves have continued to become bigger, and Brian Slack says they haven't yet reached the limit.
Ship size has grown enormously. And each time a new ship size emerges, people say, oh, that's the biggest ship that's ever going to be built. By the 1980s, ships have grown from 1,000 to 1,500 TEUs as they were in the 1970s, they were now at 4,000 TEUs. In other words, they were more than doubled in size in the space of a decade. The reason they grew to about 4,000 TEUs was the limits of the Panama Canal. The Panama Canal, which was a major thoroughfare between the Pacific and the Atlantic, was limited to vessels of about 4,200 TEUs. So what happened was, in the late 1980s, one of the shipping lines, APL, decided to build ships bigger than the Panama Canal. They're called post-Panamax ships. And there was then a spurt of growth to 6,000 and 7,000 TEUs. By the year 2000, they were pushing 8,000 or 9,000 TEUs. By 2007, they were pushing 14,000 TEUs. And by this year, 2013, 2014, ships are coming on stream which are 18,000 TEUs. So when you think back, from 1960 to the present day, we've seen an 18-fold increase in the size of vessels. Now, so far I've spoken about capacity, from 1,000 TEU capacity to 18,000 TEU capacity. That's meant the ships are going to get a lot bigger. They're a lot longer. They're now over 400 meters in length. They are wider because they've got to be able to accommodate a lot more containers. And they are certainly much deeper. They draw much more water. All these things cause problems to ports again. I mean, the effect of those dimensional changes means that ports now have to provide berths not of 200 meters or of 300 meters, but of 400 meters, which requires more and more space. They now have to have more and more cranes to work the ship, because the ship's now carrying 18,000 TEUs. They need to be offloaded quickly and effectively in the space of 2 days. And so they have to put more cranes, and those cranes are very expensive. They're $30, $40 million each. And the other very big constraint is, of course, depth of water. And this becomes a real issue, that ports that want to be in the game, as it is, who want to attract these lines that the big shipping companies are operating, will have to dredge or deepen their channels, which is a very costly item, and it's also an item that has quite a lot of environmental consequences. And so one of the challenges, I think, that containerization is going to have to face, the enormous increase in the size of vessels, which limits the number of ports that those ships can call at.
Rose George says that she was astonished by what she learned about container shipping.
Well, just the vastness of it and how it reaches everywhere and everyone. For example, I'm sitting here in a radio studio and I'm looking around, and it's very difficult for me to isolate something that I am sure did not come by ship. In fact, probably the only thing I can be sure of is the water that's in the cup. And pretty much everything else probably came by ship, because certainly in the UK, we're not really a manufacturing nation anymore, so we have to import a lot. So we are absolutely fundamentally dependent on ships, and I think that's the most astonishing thing I learnt, just how much we do depend on ships, and at the same time, how invisible the industry is.
And who've been the winners, the big winners from containerisation?
We have, if we think we're winners by having cheap clothes, cheap electronics, cheap everything. There's no way that any of that would be possible without shipping. There's no way that we could buy a $5 t-shirt without it costing so little to ship it, so it can be as little as a couple of cents per unit to ship. Shipping may not have created globalization, but it certainly underpins it. So I guess the consumer is the winner.
There's obviously been a lot of negative impacts. I think that many ports see themselves trapped in a constant cycle of having to invest in equipment, in channels, in new port facilities, which may or may not be used. And equally, I think labor has suffered significantly. But the benefits of container, I think, more than outweigh them in general. Obviously, if you're in a place like Baltimore, an American port which has lost a lot of container business, or at least until fairly recently, I think that the viewpoint from there is, we've lost out. But containerization has helped and facilitated globalization. World trade has expanded. We wouldn't have had, in my opinion, the enormous expansion of international trade without the container. The growth of China and the industrialization of China, I don't think would have occurred to the same degree as it has without the container. And I think that globalization, for better or for worse, has been one of the products of containerization.
Professor Brian Slack of Concordia University in Canada. The other guests on Rear Vision today were Rose George, the author of 90% of Everything, and Dr. John Paul Rodrigue from Hofstra University in New York. Judy Rapley is the sound engineer for today's Rear Vision. I'm Keri Phillips. Bye till next time.